Back in colonial India, the British Raj had a huge problem with deadly cobras that were killing livestock and interrupting their plantations. To try to curb the menace, the government offered a bounty for every snake that was killed to cut down on their population. This was initially hugely successful, as people could earn more by hunting snakes than they could by doing almost any job at the time. But eventually, Indian farmers figured out that they could make even more money by breeding the snakes to have a reliable form of income. After the British Raj found out about this hustle, he shut the program down entirely, so the farmers freed their snakes, leading to the whole cobra program being worse than when the scheme started. Economists call these perverse incentives, and you might think we are smarter than this today. But we are not. The same mistakes made by the British Raj back in colonial times are being made by people dealing with some of the biggest issues in the world today. Perverse incentives, once you understand them, can explain everything from the homelessness crisis that only ever seems to get worse, to the meteoric rise of private equity, all the way to people simply giving up on work altogether.
Found that BART spent hundreds of thousands of dollars on a homeless outreach program that resulted in one confirmed homeless person getting its services.
$837,000 per housing unit for the homeless.
I found out through a customer who showed up at the locked doors. General manager never reached out. Corporate never reached out.
Golden Gate Capital stripped away all the real estate, valuable real estate.
Dude, less than 20% of the country likes their f***ing job.
America has a homelessness crisis as record numbers of people are ending up on the streets in a few concentrated city centers. Cities are spending billions of dollars on failing projects to try and solve this problem, which has attracted a growing list of companies happy to provide their services for a price. Helping the homeless has become a lucrative business, with multi-million dollar government contracts awarded every day. But if there's so much money to be made, do these companies really want a long-term fix?
Over how much Austin's new homeless shelter
is going to cost hundreds of homeless families being housed in hotels across the state because there's no more room left in emergency shelters.
49 apartments for the homeless, built at a whopping $739,000 a unit.
According to a report by the consulting firm McKinsey & Co., the annual budget for the Los Angeles Homeless Services Authority rose from $63 million in 2015 to $808 million in 2022, a 1,300% increase in just 7 years. And what did the hardworking taxpayers of Los Angeles get for their money? The number of homeless people went up by 56%. Ignoring for the moment that everybody deserves the right to affordable, comfortable shelter, there is something not quite adding up here. A closer look at individual programs like the Inside Safe Homelessness Reduction Policy doesn't make it much better. The idea of this program was to have social workers offer hotel rooms to homeless individuals while they sought out longer-term housing arrangements. Data collected by the city and compiled by local news outlet The Center Square found that the plan had cost $250 million over just 1 year. The program only served 1,463 individuals, which works out to be $17,000 per individual per month. That is over $200,000 every year being spent on one individual in one program in just one city in America. So where the f*** is all this money going? And at what point would it be easier to give homeless people checks for 3 times the national salary? Well, there are 3 reasons why cities across America and the rest of the world are spending more money than ever on this problem while not making it any better. The first reason is the broken structure trying to fix a difficult problem. Hanlon's razor is an adage that says you should never attribute malice to what is adequately explained by stupidity. With so much taxpayer money funding failed programs, you might think of evil corporations profiting off the misery of society's most vulnerable, but that isn't the biggest problem. Most people involved in homeless relief efforts are making below average incomes and are really trying to make a difference. Most of them, not all of them. But you will see that later. The homeless industrial complex is actually a combination of bad management structures, bad incentives, and bad market conditions. Tim Campbell is a journalist and public auditor who wrote an article about the organizations involved in this industry and the failures of their process. The Los Angeles Homeless Services Authority is a joint powers authority that gets funding from federal, state, county, and city budgets, but it doesn't actually do any of the work itself. According to the authority's own website, the LAHSA offers funding program design, outcomes assessment, and technical assistance to more than 100 nonprofit partner agencies that assist people in experiencing homelessness achieve independence and stability in permanent housing. So they are a middleman between funding and over 100 nonprofits. that give the money to these organizations to achieve goals, like offering hotel rooms to people until they can get back on their feet, and then assess the performance after a project has been finished to determine if it was successful or not. With so many organizations all doing different things, proper oversight is very difficult. In the 2022-2023 fiscal year, just over $40 million of the Homeless Authority's revenue was spent on administration. The organization that only runs a few programs of their own has over 750 employees, primarily dedicated to liaising with their nonprofit partners, overseen by highly paid executives including the CEO of public organization Valicia Adams-Kellum, who is paid a base salary of $430,000 per year according to public records. Attractive compensation is important in any company. If you offer low compensation, you should expect bad results, which is not what such a troubled organization needs. But according to SalaryCube and the Bureau of Labor Statistics, this is roughly double the pay of the average CEO for organizations of this size in the private sector. But that's not actually the biggest problem. Most of the money entering this program goes to nonprofit partners. But since each of them are contracted for niche roles across dozens of different programs, the real work is bogged down in endless siloing of responsibilities and overhead. In his article, Tim Campbell talks about an experience where one agency provides outreach, another operates a shelter, a third provides support services, a fourth builds supportive housing, and a fifth manages housing's operations. Even though these are nonprofit organizations, they all want to protect their role so their people can keep their jobs, and they frequently get into turf wars over whose responsibility is what. They also don't have a direct line of communication to one another, since all reporting goes back through the LAHSA. Something like booking a hotel room for someone to spend the night in took the involvement of 10 nonprofit organizations, the police, hotel staff, and an oversight team at the LAHSA. That makes it almost impossible for the authority to provide assessment of the performance of a program because it gets bogged down in endless, "that wasn't my job," between all the unrelated nonprofits it works with. That would be bad enough if it wasn't for the fact that the Housing Authority isn't even the central authority within Los Angeles. Within just this one city, different homeless issues are handled by the LAHSA, the Chief of Housing and Homeless Solutions, County Homeless Services, the California Department of Housing and Community Development, the Federal Interagency Council of Homelessness, in addition to federal, state, city, and local police departments. Every agency has overhead, like offices and administration staff, that take money away from fixing the problems at hand. And that's before you learn about the people that are deliberately taking advantage of all of this for profit. So it's time to learn how money works to find out why throwing money at complicated problems is not fixing it. Outreach staff working in dangerous areas on a volunteer basis or for very little pay are not part of a shadowy cabal to profit off the homeless epidemic. But there are other players in this game. A major problem caused by the disjoint departmentalization of services is that recipients can pick and choose what programs they access and what programs they reject. The individual organizations within this sprawling private-public structure have no way to stop recipients being very selective with their services, and according to multiple insiders, they actually encourage it. Kevin Dahlgren is a former social services worker who has written about his experiences working in a Housing First center in Portland, Oregon. Housing First was a federal initiative to fix homelessness by giving people homes. But other services like addiction treatment, mental health support, and workplace training were handled separately. People can't have government treatment programs forced upon them unless they are institutionalized, which would only make the situation worse. The result of the program, according to Dahlgren and other service workers, is that homeless housing buildings would not provide a place for people to stay off the streets, but would just concentrate all the problems that put people there in the first place. If you ever wanted to see clear proof that this is a complicated issue, then you should know that Dahlgren, who has been a tireless advocate for support services reform, was recently arrested on charges of alleged identity theft involving the disadvantaged people he previously worked with. He has pled not guilty, but the case is still ongoing. The data itself backs up his point, though. The uptake of housing programs has been higher than the uptake of support programs across the country. A study by the University of Chicago on permanent housing solutions found that many homeless people actually avoid these services because they see them as more dangerous than being on the street. Advocacy groups claim the stereotype of housing centers being dangerous is a damaging myth. But if they really were safe, then it gets even harder to justify spending so much money on such poor results. In an interview with CNN, Jason Elliott, a senior advisor on homelessness to Governor Gavin Newsom, defended the state of California spending $17.5 billion. That much money would have been enough to just pay rent at market rates for every homeless person in the state, with around $4 billion left over. Elliott pointed out that this wouldn't work because of the significant behavioral health challenges these people face, requiring housing solutions to have controls in place. Okay, There is more than just bad management at play here. All of this chaos is covering up the second reason that homelessness is getting worse while costing you more. California, New York, and Oregon have been heavily featured so far, because they have the highest rate of homelessness in the country. And it should be no surprise that the problem of people not having a house has a lot to do with those houses themselves. These states attract a lot of people, who move to them for career opportunities, and they have expensive real estate markets. As someone who has lived in both San Francisco and LA, I witnessed the problem of unaffordable housing myself. Since moving here, I have had good-paying jobs as an investment banker, and now as a full-time YouTuber. But even then, I have struggled to afford a small apartment. I am grateful to be a lot more financially stable now. But fresh out of college, if I lost my job and couldn't find a new one within weeks, I would have to move back home. A study by the University of California, San Francisco found that the number one reason why people experience homelessness was simply because they lost their income in cities where a place to live is expensive. The study also found that a vast majority of surveyed respondents could have avoided homelessness with a subsidy of less than $300 a month, which is already far cheaper than the cost to help someone once they are already homeless. A clear criticism of housing programs in these states is the cost of the housing solutions themselves. The San Diego Housing Commission is planning to use $150 million in state funding to purchase a 400-room extended stay hotel that could be quickly converted into housing. That's a per unit cost of $383,000 for something that is not much more than a basic hotel room with a kitchenette. The purchase was defended by the government and real estate experts in an article by the San Diego Tribune, because it simply wasn't possible to find housing close to services like public transport for less than that in the city. If $300 a month could prevent the city from buying more of these units, that would clearly pay for itself. But at what point are taxpayers just subsidizing rent for people moving to LA to become an actor? And that's the third reason why homelessness is only getting worse. It's become a political football. The UC San Francisco study also looked at common claims like the one that homeless people are moving to California because services here are better than what they could receive in other states. Politicians from both sides of the aisle will make this claim as a way to discredit the support efforts of other states, or the soft-handed approach of California. The study actually found that 90% of surveyed people suffering homelessness became homeless while already living in California. Okay, so people do move here, but they are only a minor part of the problem. This is a big issue that affects lots of voters. People want a solution to this problem, because nobody likes to see other people struggling, and they are also sick of having their cars broken into, or their streets filled with tents and droppings. Politicians can score easy points by coming up with a new solution to lump on top of the old solutions, or by pointing out that their constituency is not having the same problem. Politicians also can't do much about the existing problems because they employ so many people. The cobweb of intergovernmental ineffectiveness might not be very good at getting people off the streets, but it is very good at providing employment. Every nonprofit, government authority, administrative department, and private sector provider in this mess is keeping people in a job. A more efficient solution would yield better results, but nobody wants to be the politician responsible for getting rid of that many jobs. The federal tax code, when written out from beginning to end, is about 2,600 pages long. Depending on who you ask, it can be as long as 70,000 pages if you include all the relevant legal rulings on the contents of the code itself. This snowballing complexity would be a big enough headache by itself. But the biggest problem of all is that the federal government only collects about a dozen different taxes. The guidelines on what these taxes are, how they are calculated, and how they are collected takes up a total of about 250 pages. Everything else in the code is allowances, credits, deductions, offsets, incentives, and deferments. And that's just federal taxes. Things become exponentially more complicated when local and state taxes are included as well. Now, it doesn't matter if you believe that all taxes are theft, or if you think that the rich should be taxed out of existence. The current system is broken in just the right way.
By exploiting a complex tax system filled with loopholes, the richest 1% pay a lot less than the average taxpayer.
Just under $7 million in federal taxes, that is 17.4%. of his taxable income, which Buffett has said is way too low.
You know, and not only should we pay more taxes, but there also should be a differentiation. There should not be a differentiation between capital gains and regular income.
Okay, so it's no secret that tax loopholes benefit the rich. And that's for two reasons. However, most people choose to just focus on one. The first reason is because wealthy people can afford to pay the billable hours of accountants and tax lawyers to set up their personal finances and business structures to take advantage of these loopholes. According to the National Association of Tax Professionals, the average cost to prepare an individual return in America in 2023 was $248. That's already more expensive than it should be. But tax services go way up from there. Tailored tax services that submit the paperwork required to take advantage of some of these loopholes can cost tens of thousands of dollars every year to put together. That means that it's only worth it for people that can save hundreds of thousands of dollars in tax by diligently structuring their affairs. The second reason that tax loopholes only benefit the rich is because they are the ones that pay tax. According to data from the IRS and compiled by the Tax Foundation, roughly 153 million Americans paid federal income taxes in 2021. That's about half the population. Of those, the top 1% of earners paid almost half of all income taxes. That just mathematically means that anything to offset taxes is going to benefit higher income earners more than people earning less. The Tax Foundation is a think tank that lobbies for lower, flatter taxes, so it does have an agenda with this data, but it's still pulled directly from the IRS, so the numbers don't lie. But the fact that thousands of pages of tax loopholes is good for high income earners isn't actually the problem. Hot take alert, but let me explain. On this income chart, where would you place Jeff Bezos? Probably the top 1%, right? He is, after all, one of the richest men in the world. But depending on the year, he has actually spent just as much time down here. According to tax document leaks published by ProPublica, in 2011, Jeff Bezos legally reported an income so low that he actually qualified for and claimed a $4,000 tax credit for his children. The people who actually make up most of the 1% of highest income earners are more often highly skilled professionals like doctors, lawyers, and tech workers who still get a regular W-2 paycheck or draw a salary from their small business but can't defer their income to when it's convenient for them and their team of accountants. But while criticizing a system that counts a man like this as low income and in need of family assistance is fun and easy, it distracts from three other more serious problems with the overcomplication of the tax code. The first major problem is that it lifts up some businesses while pushing down others. One of the reasons why homes have become so unaffordable is because they are treated like a financial asset as much as they are like a place for people to live their lives. Homes have several advantages over other financial assets that make them particularly attractive to investors of all sizes, from small-time landlords with a single rental property all the way to the largest investment firms on the planet. If you want to invest into real estate, you can get cheap leverage through a mortgage that won't be margin called like a loan to buy other financial assets. Real estate also cash flows well, so in the right markets, your rental income could cover your mortgage repayments. But as if real estate needed a sweetener, there is also an extensive list of tax benefits available to real estate investors. For example, a 1031 exchange lets a real estate investor sell their property for a profit and not pay any capital gains taxes as long as they use the money to buy one or more other properties of equal or greater value within 180 days. This means real estate is one of the few investment vehicles where you can trade up a portfolio while deferring taxes indefinitely. Or put another way, incentives for hoarding real estate are literally written into the tax code. Just this incentive is so common that it's become its own verb amongst savvy property investors. They will 1031 a property, which means they will trade it up for bigger property or more properties while saving on the tax. Real estate has so many tax incentives that the Federal Office of the Comptroller set up a directory to help people navigate what they are eligible for. The reason these incentives exist is because at one point in time, the government thought it would be a good idea to encourage property investment. The 1031 exchange dates back over 100 years to 1921, when it was first introduced. Back then, real estate investing was very different from today. The good news is that America isn't the worst example of this. Canada, China, New Zealand, and especially Australia have even more generous tax incentives for real estate, so perhaps it's unsurprising that their housing is even less affordable. But in America, it's not just real estate. The property market may be one of the most distorted markets for tax incentives, but there are 9,834 sections in the tax code that have all accumulated over decades. It is very easy to pass new tax incentives. It's almost impossible to take them away without getting voted out. Anytime the government wants to incentivize some new type of business, investing, or labor activity, they can create a tax incentive to achieve it, and that's created a landscape where it's just more tax efficient to run your own business, your savings, and your investments in a certain way, even if it comes at the expense of the wider economy. But distorting already highly problematic markets is just the first problem with the loophole arms race. According to a report by ProPublica, someone earning $20,000 a year is now more likely to be audited by the IRS than someone earning over $400,000 a year. This is because the IRS is so underfunded and so understaffed that it can't argue its own tax code as well as the private sector tax lawyers representing wealthy individuals. To maintain its audit numbers, the IRS has resorted to a strategy I like to call sledgehammering blueberries, where they will come down hard on the softest, easiest targets. The earned income tax credit is another overly complicated tax incentive, but this one is given to low-income households to encourage them to earn their own income instead of relying solely on welfare. This is a great idea, but the problem is the instructions for claiming this credit are 41 pages of very dense financial and legal jargon. Michelle Lyon Drumble, a tax professor at Washington and Lee School of Law, reported in an interview with ProPublica that even her third-year law students couldn't understand these IRS guidelines. So what hope does an untrained worker making a minimum wage have? The incentive to audit low-income workers trying to get a basic credit sounds bad, but it's just one symptom of the second problem with an overly complex tax system. Filing taxes is expensive, stressful, and time-consuming. You need to play a game with the IRS where you both think of a number, and if they don't match, you get hit with an even more stressful and time-consuming audit. This means that almost everybody filing a tax return needs to pay for the service of a professional tax accountant, even if they have really simple finances. I was a financial professional for about half a decade, and even I wouldn't dare do my taxes without an accountant. Every year, Americans spend hundreds of thousands of dollars to work out how much they have to give Uncle Sam. But it doesn't have to be like this. Most other advanced countries don't have this system. Most other tax agencies tell their citizens how much they owe from their tax withholdings from their paycheck. From this number, you can still claim deductions as they are allowed. But the system is simple and user-friendly enough that most people can prepare and lodge accurate returns for themselves in under an hour. America has been trying to make simple tax returns a thing from as far back as Reagan, who promised a return-free system like these other countries. But today, according to a report by the IRS themselves, Americans spend a collective 2 billion hours preparing personal tax returns. If those man hours were spent on working something productive at the average national rate, it would be over $220 billion in additional economic output. Or put another way, approximately the GDP of Hungary is wasted on doing taxes every year. There are two reasons that we still have this system, despite politicians from both sides of the aisle pushing the easy alternative. The first reason is intense political lobbying from tax preparation companies that profit off this inefficiency. According to Open Secrets and regulatory filings, TurboTax's parent company Intuit spent a record $3.8 million on federal lobbying in 2023 alone. That's just one tax preparation company in 1 year, so it's safe to say that the political will to fix the system has been eroded. The second reason you have to play the guessing game with the IRS every year is that our tax code is simply too complicated to make a return-free system work for most people like it does in most other advanced economies. And that's the third major problem with the tax loophole arms race. It makes people hate taxes. You probably hate taxes, but how much of that is because you hate actually giving your money to Uncle Sam, and how much of that is because you hate the stress and time that goes into them? Making taxes suck is a very good way to make people vote for a system that sounds more simple, even if it's not in their financial best interest. Here's a question for you. Why are long-term capital gains taxed at a lower rate than the income tax for high earners? The top federal tax rate for people working for an income is 37% before state income taxes and FICA, but the long-term capital gains tax rate is a maximum of 20%, with the vast majority of people paying just 15%. So why do people who work for their money pay more in taxes than people who sit on appreciating assets? There are two technical answers and one real answer. The first technical reason that is often used to explain this disparity is that inflation makes things more expensive over time, even if their real value hasn't improved. If you buy a house for $100,000 and then 20 years later sell it for $200,000, you would have $100,000 in capital gains. But if inflation halved the purchasing power of the dollar in that time, then even though you have made no real gain, you would still owe $15,000 in capital gains taxes. The argument is that a lower capital gains tax is only fair to offset this kind of thing. The second argument was first put forth by Tony Atkinson and Joseph Stiglitz in a paper titled The Design of Tax Structure, where they said that taxes on investment profits were unnecessary because the money to buy assets comes from labor income anyway, so taxing those assets is unnecessary double taxation. Even Stiglitz himself later admitted that this thinking was flawed, because there are other ways to obtain assets other than working for them. But people were still very happy to promote these ideas because it justified the real reason that taxes have remained so favorable, and that's because capital gains income is really what most of the world's richest people actually live on. Tax reform is very hard when the only people that have the time and expertise to understand it are the ones benefiting from the current broken system. and everybody else just wants to ignore their taxes until they have to deal with them next year. Business decisions made in the interest of maximizing shareholder value have caused mass layoffs, environmental catastrophes, an endless list of corporate frauds, and record inequality in the workplace. The very same CEO who made millions of dollars by being the first champion of maximizing shareholder value in the 60s called it the dumbest idea in the world, and something that could rot capitalism to its core. But worst of all, maximizing shareholder value isn't even good for the shareholders.
Indeed, managers, the CEO, have a fiduciary duty to their shareholders to be concerned only with the bottom line. We think this is wrong, a serious mistake.
But continue to create the capacity to be able to reward our shareholders as we have done in 2023 and as we hope to continue to do in 2024.
Roundtable today sparking a debate about the purpose of a corporation and why maximizing shareholder returns is no longer the main goal.
If you hate your job, here is a history lesson for you that might make it start to make sense. In 1916, the Ford Motor Company had revolutionized the automobile industry with the Ford Model T. Henry Ford, the founder and majority stockholder of the company, wanted to use the surplus cash they had accumulated to build additional plants and hire even more workers to build even more cars. Ford had also famously, and controversially, raised factory worker wages significantly and offered benefits like the 40-hour work week. In press interviews, Ford spoke about his plans for the company. "My ambition is to employ still more men, to spread the benefits of the industrial system to the greatest possible number, to help them build up their lives and their homes. To do this, we are putting the greatest share of our profits back into the business." This angered minority shareholders in the company that just wanted him to lower wages again, raise the price of the Model T, and keep paying them a regular dividend. Since Ford was the majority shareholder in the company, though, their options were limited. So they took him to court. But the court sided with the minority shareholders. Ford was forced to consider the best interests of shareholders above his other business ambitions. This was the case that set the precedent for shareholder primacy in America, meaning the board of directors and executives in a company must always try to maximize shareholder value to the best of their ability. Some have mistaken this ruling to mean that CEOs and the boards that appoint them have a legal mandate to maximize shareholder value, but the reality is that this simply isn't true. The case was awarded in favor of the minority shareholders, but it upheld the business judgment rule, which means that executives can do what they believe is in the best interest of the company, even if it doesn't make the number on a stock chart go up. Ford himself wasn't paying his workers more and making new jobs because he wanted to be nice. He was a ruthless businessman who wanted to control a larger share of the growing automobile market. By paying his workers better and offering them higher wages, he was just denying his competitors a workforce. And by pricing his Model Ts just above cost, he made it almost impossible for any other manufacturer to sell a profitable budget automobile. The biggest irony of all of this is the minority shareholders that took Ford to court were John and Horace Dodge. They owned about 10% of the company and used their special dividends to fund growth of their own company, Dodge, a car maker that would eventually become one of Ford Motor's biggest rivals. So this court ruling was bad for the company's leaders, bad for workers, bad for the country, and bad for the shareholders in Ford who sacrificed market dominance for a quick payday. But there are three reasons why people still believe in maximizing shareholder value, and three reasons why companies that operate this way are almost guaranteed to fail. Corporate America didn't always have the dangerous obsession with shareholder value that it does today. And even after the landmark Dodge versus Ford case in 1919, companies were slow to change. Between the mid-1960s and 1970s, American stock markets traded mostly sideways. Corporate CEOs still had a duty to do what was best for the company, but they were paid a normal salary and a small bonus just like every other normal employee. According to the Economic Policy Institute and the National Bureau of Labor Statistics, CEOs at this time made around 20 times as much as the average employee of their company. So they were still rich, but not so rich that they could retire after one good year. Their motivation was primarily to keep the company running safely so they could maintain their well-paid jobs for as long as possible. By the 1990s, a small group of financiers got the idea that in order to grow to get better returns from their companies, they should align the interests of their CEO with their own interests of getting the stock price as high as possible. They did this by paying the CEOs a smaller cash salary, but added stock options that directly tied CEO bonuses to stock performance. In the 1990s, CEO compensation went from 60 times average worker pay to 380 times average worker pay. My friend Patrick Boyle did a great video on how this small change in corporate norms eventually led to people like Elon Musk demanding $50 billion in compensation for 1 year's work. Now that there was so much money to be made, CEOs and other senior executives were happy to go along with the lie that it was their legal duty to maximize shareholder value, even if it would destroy their companies in the long term. The first strategy they used was picking up pennies in front of a steamroller. It won't surprise you that some of the biggest companies in the world have taken dumb risks. We have seen some of the biggest corporate bankruptcies in history happen in just the past 24 months, and it's becoming more common. If you are a CEO with a multi-million dollar bonus package on the table, you are going to do everything in your power to tick the boxes you need for the board to grant you that bonus. A top priority for you as the CEO is going to be to increase your company stock price, pay a big dividend, or both. Most bonuses are awarded year to year, and according to Fortune magazine, the average tenure of a Fortune 500 CEO is now only 7 years. For you, big projects that could pay off over decades are effectively useless, unless their announcement could drive up your stock price. But even that's unlikely. Investors rarely care about long-term business strategies because they so rarely come true anyway. Your best strategy is to control bad publicity and focus on next quarter's financials. An easy place to cut expenses is in areas like security, auditing, risk management, safety controls, long-term development, and training. If you cut these enough, you might even increase revenue at the same time, because sales staff and revenue centers can operate more freely without pesky compliance departments making sure things aren't being done illegally. Silicon Valley Bank, one of the largest bank failures in American history, had a risk management department that regulators described as terrible. That's about the harshest thing that financial regulators say about anything. Lehman Brothers went bankrupt because it couldn't say no to the revenue it was making from subprime mortgage bonds. Boeing's repeated string of airline failures has been blamed on a push to get new planes into the air by cutting down on safety controls and testing. HSBC, one of the biggest banks in the world, made billions of dollars in revenue by providing financial services to international criminals. People have lost their jobs, lost savings, and lost their lives in these scandals. But worse than all of that, the shareholders lost billions of dollars from scandals like these and others that are too numerous to list. But the CEOs that ultimately oversaw the companies making these terrible risk trade-offs already made their enormous bonuses, and some of them even got a golden parachute on the way out. Business departments like risk management and cybersecurity have tough jobs. If everything is going well, people question what good they are doing for the business. If things are going badly, people question what good they are doing for the business. You can make a little money by picking up pennies in front of a steamroller, but if something goes wrong, you get smushed all for a few dollars. The short-sighted nature of CEOs mandated to maximize shareholder value is also the second reason it's one of the worst ideas in the history of business. It guarantees that businesses become worse. Jack Welch was the chairman and CEO of General Electric from 1981 to 2001. He worked his way up in the company from an entry-level position, but upon stepping into the top job, he radically reshaped the company in the name of the shareholders. Welch made 72,000 of GE's 400,000 employees redundant. He sold off entire company divisions, and he invested heavily in financial and media arms of the business. GE Capital became the primary focus of an engineering company that made consumer appliances, commercial machinery, and aerospace parts. Welch also pioneered outsourcing and bragged about it on CNBC. A news network he created to focus on business news after GE acquired NBC. His ruthless strategy worked, and during his 20 years as CEO, GE's stock price rose from $6 a share to a high of almost $370 a share a year before being asked to walk away from the company. He did, but not before being awarded an exit package estimated at $417 million. Other CEOs who were now getting paid mainly with stock options saw this maverick CEO talking about his strategies on his own news network, and they figured they couldn't argue with the results. According to data from the Economic Policy Institute, the year that Jack Welch took over as the CEO of General Electric was the last year when increases in worker productivity kept pace with increases in wages. Make of that what you would. Welch's focus on shareholder above every other stakeholder in the business worked well for a long time. But since he was pushed out of the company, the stock price of GE has fallen by roughly 70% from its all-time high, even during a record bull run where the market is up by 400%. GE used to make high-quality products that customers were highly loyal to. GE's outsourcing delivered worse products to the market, leading customers to buy from other brands. GE used to be one of the most attractive companies to work for because they were stable, paid well, and let employees, like Jack Welch himself, work their way up the corporate ladder. GE's CEO proudly boasting about mass layoffs and firing the bottom 10% of staff every year meant it became one of the least desirable companies to work for, so top talent went elsewhere. By sacrificing customers and employees to appease shareholders, they made it worse for them, too. Welch himself even said in an interview that maximizing shareholder value was stupid. A high stock price is the result of doing everything else correctly. Why didn't he follow his own advice? Well, because he made too much money by keeping the people that paid him happy. During Welch's tenure as CEO, GE was almost suspiciously good at meeting financial goals. Roger Martin, the dean of the Rotman School of Business at the University of Toronto, said in an interview with Forbes that GE met or beat analyst forecasts in 46 of 48 quarters between December 31, 1989 and September 30, 2001, a 96% hit rate. Even more impressive, in 41 of those 46 quarters, GE hit the analyst forecasts to the exact penny, 89% perfection. Of course, this wasn't amazing management. It was good old-fashioned creative accounting, a practice that got GE in hot water with the SEC and was part of the reason why Welch was eventually asked to nicely leave the company. Despite his tarnished record, Welch's business practices are still common in a lot of corporate boardrooms across the world. Okay, so you might ask if encouraging CEOs to pursue short-term gains has shown to be bad for everyone, including the shareholders who appoint the board, who employ the CEO, why are companies still doing this? Well, that's because the third reason why maximizing shareholder value is a terrible idea for everyone. The short term is all that matters. According to data from the largest stock exchanges in America, the average holding period for stocks has been consistently declining for decades. In 1975, investors held onto stocks for an average of 5 years. In 2021, they held onto them for less than 1 year. Electronic brokerages have made buying and selling shares much easier. And people are generally in financial situations that are much less secure, where selling shares becomes a way to cover an unexpected expense. That's not how long-term investing should be done, but staying ahead financially these days is hard. The largest dips in shareholder holding periods happened in 2001 and 2008, during down markets and job losses where people were probably selling at a loss on their holdings but needed to cover their expenses one way or another. Long-term capital gains tax laws also encourage people to seek profits from buying and selling year to year rather than a dividend strategy, which can be less tax efficient. The result is that if people are holding onto shares for less time, then they also only care about short-term wins. So a CEO that delivers a profitable fourth quarter will be more popular than a CEO who reinvests company earnings into training, R&D, or safety that won't pay off for years. This kind of short-term thinking is not sustainable, but that's another shareholder and CEO's problem. In 2012, the Hong Kong Shanghai Banking Corporation, best known simply as HSBC, was charged by authorities for aiding and abetting operations of some criminal cartels between the US and Mexico. The bank was found to have systematic failures in its anti-money laundering or AML controls, which, in addition to helping the cartels, also assisted Iran and North Korea circumvent nuclear weapons sanctions. Corporate personhood is the legal notion that corporations have many of the same legal rights and responsibilities enjoyed by natural flesh and blood people. They can own property, sue and be sued, donate to political campaigns, and even have defended religious beliefs. But if a normal person was found laundering money for cartels and the North Korean nuclear program, they would be living it up here at ADX Florence. If they were lucky. HSBC, on the other hand, still operates across the world. And their punishment for these crimes would be like a normal person getting a fine for roughly 2 months of their wages. So, if corporations are legally people, why can't they be arrested?
Are you arguing to let airlines, for example, fail?
Yes.
Why? I mean, how does that make sense in the broader scheme of the economy?
Another Boeing whistleblower has died.
A second Boeing whistleblower, now dead.
What they're really telling you is they just won't fight for it. Well, healthcare is a basic human right. And I will fight for basic human rights.
Corporate greed loose in our healthcare system kills people.
Attorney General Lanny Brewer, who was in charge of the HSBC case, resisted criminal prosecution because that could potentially cause the bank to lose its U.S. charter to operate as a bank in America. That would be a death blow to HSBC, because an international bank that can't move U.S. dollars would be about as competitive as a Home Depot that couldn't sell hammers. In a press release, he stated, "Our goal here is not to bring HSBC down. It's not to cause a systematic effect on the economy. It's not for people to lose thousands of jobs." It's very unusual to have a criminal prosecutor directly say to the media that their intention is not to bring down the party that they are prosecuting. The Wikipedia section for all of HSBC's controversies is longer than the Wikipedia page for the Pope. But this is still just one company that speaks to a bigger problem of being too big to jail. If companies see fines as just the cost of doing business, what reasonable punishments are there for organizations that break the law, which doesn't just end up punishing innocent employees and the wider economy more than it does the people with actual discretion over how these companies act? Last week, Senator Elizabeth Warren proposed a new law that would hold investment executives criminally liable if their cost-cutting measures in healthcare facilities cause death. If you can't put the companies in prison, at least you can put the people who own them in there. So now we are getting somewhere, right? Wrong. The new proposal was specifically targeted at buyout private equity funds who have done some serious damage to the healthcare industry, an industry that was barely holding it together as it was. We have already made two videos about how private equity squeezes out profits from some extreme cost-cutting measures and why the healthcare industry has been one of their biggest targets so far. According to the Wall Street Journal's private equity division, Warren first made the proposal in a visit to St. Elizabeth's Medical Center in Boston. The hospital wasn't named after her. It was, presumably, another Elizabeth. The hospital was part of the Steward healthcare system, which filed for bankruptcy in April following financial struggles that allegedly started with its previous private equity owner, Cerberus Capital Management, an investment firm that specializes in acquiring healthcare businesses. Like most leveraged buyouts, the hospital group was loaded up with debt to increase leverage, and it had to pay significant management fees to the private equity company for their Ivy League business advice, which was clearly so good that it led them to complete insolvency. To pay for these fees and cover this interest, significant cost cutting was needed to be made so that the hospitals could still look profitable to future investors, and that meant worse care for patients. According to a study conducted on over 4.5 million hospital patients run by healthcare publication the JAMA Network, the rate of hospital-acquired conditions like fall injuries, infections, and pharmaceutical side effects were more than 25% higher in private equity-controlled hospitals, primarily because they had fewer staff to give patients adequate care. So, the proposal to hold these investors liable when the stripped-back care causes severe injury or death would be a great way to control this trend. But unfortunately, it would be next to impossible to properly legislate. People go to hospitals when they are sick. And differentiating between a death caused by natural causes, a death caused by malpractice, and a death caused by the systematic cost-cutting of healthcare facilities is extremely difficult, to say the least. Private equity buyout funds are an easy punching bag to score some easy political points in an election year. People have become more aware of the industry, and the more they learn about it, the less they like it. But as much of these kinds of laws are overdue, especially in vital industries like healthcare, they would be almost impossible to legislate. The line between getting the people truly doing harm for undue personal enrichment and putting someone in prison for investing in a healthcare business is very blurry. And I can tell you from experience that private equity is very savvy when it comes to political lobbying. In the run-up to the last presidential election, Warren herself unveiled a similar plan, which is still available on her website, which would reform the private equity industry and level the playing field by forcing private equity firms to take responsibility for the outcomes of companies they take over. If it sounds familiar, it's because it's pretty much the exact same proposal. So you shouldn't be surprised if this proposal is quietly forgotten about after the next election. It's easy to criticize. It's hard to fix problems this ingrained into our systems. The cathartic solution to companies that are willfully negligent, criminally culpable, or just plain greedy at the expense of human life would be to shut them down so they can no longer pose a danger to society. But even though companies enjoy most of the benefits of being a legal person like you or I, they don't get many of the drawbacks like being thrown in prison if they break the law. Authorities can technically shut down most companies if they wanted to by revoking licenses or charters, but that rarely happens anymore. And that's because the rules of the game have been written in such a way that it would almost always do more harm than good. This all began in 2002 with the collapse of Enron, the second largest case of corporate fraud in history after only the recent collapse of FTX. The story is not actually about Enron itself. It's about the company that signed off on their books, the accounting firm Arthur Andersen. According to the company's last filings, they employed 28,000 people and had an annual revenue of $9.3 billion. This made them competitive with KPMG, Deloitte, EY, and PwC. In the early 2000s, these weren't the Big Four. They were known as the Big Five. But Arthur Andersen was put on trial for its involvement in the fraud and found guilty for obstruction of justice for shredding documents related to the audit of Enron. The firm surrendered its licenses and closed down. But a later appeal to the Supreme Court overturned the ruling, because the jury instructions failed to convey the requisite consciousness of wrongdoing. In plain English, the prosecutors pushed too hard to get a conviction that they broke some rules which overturned the conviction. This was a national embarrassment to the prosecutors, who were responsible for destroying a billion-dollar company and a major employer that didn't technically break any laws. Nobody wanted to repeat these mistakes, which has led to a culture where companies just get handed a fine and everybody quietly moves on pretending they made a difference. Duke University School of Law professor Brando Garrett coined the term too big to jail in his 2014 book of the same name, where he highlighted the case of Arthur Anderson as the last time authorities were willing to actually punish companies in a way that couldn't just be brushed off as the cost of doing business. Garrett noted that the number of fines issued to corporations has been increasing at an exponential rate, but the number of convictions that would actually shut down companies has declined over the same time, because prosecutors didn't want another Arthur Anderson situation. No lawmaker wants to be responsible for shutting down a bank or hospital that provides jobs to thousands of people and essential services to millions, so they hand down a fine and quietly move on with it. It's the politically safe option, even though a look at the numbers will say it shouldn't be. Corporate crimes are often simply more harmful than individual crimes. According to a study conducted by the Economic Policy Institute, wage theft amongst just low-income workers was more than $50 billion a year. And this was back in 2014, before the widespread adoption of gig work. That is far more than the collective total of all burglaries, robberies, and motor vehicle thefts in the same year, combined. According to the National Bureau of Economic Research, investment firms have been responsible for 20,000 premature deaths over the past 12 years in just the aged care industry alone. The problem that Garrett points out in his book is that even tough-on-crime prosecutors take a very light touch when going after corporations for four reasons, and the potential impact on jobs and services is just the first reason. The second is because laws are much harder to pin on an entity that can blame its actions on suppliers, rogue employees, market conditions, past executives, or just their good old-fashioned mandate to maximize value for their shareholders. Companies can also afford much better lawyers than the average criminal, which makes shifting blame and striking up agreements a lot easier. The third reason prosecutors don't go after criminal corporations as hard as regular criminals is because even though companies claim to be a legal person, they aren't, really. The imagery of throwing handcuffs on a scary-looking person accused of a grisly crime is a lot easier to sell when it's an actual person. Finally, of course there is a revolving door between corporations and authorities. A regular flesh-and-blood criminal isn't going to be handing out jobs to talented legal prosecutors, but big companies might be, so there is a logical incentive for both sides to play along with counting a fine as a reasonable punishment. So what is the solution then? Companies could always just be given bigger fines. If they actually impact profit for shareholders, then boards will put more pressure on management to avoid, you know, committing crimes. But it can be hard to size these fines correctly. Too much, and it could just bankrupt the company, which authorities don't want to do. And if it's not enough, then it just becomes the cost of doing business all over again. In 2019, Facebook was fined $5 billion for privacy violations by the FTC. And after the announcement, the company's stock went up, because investors saw it as a sign that nothing was really going to change with the business. Another book, also called Too Big to Jail, was written in 2022 by investigative business journalist Chris Blackhurst. As an aside, if you want a sign that this is a real problem, there are two different books talking about inadequate corporate punishment. Blackhurst's book chronicled the crimes of HSBC, but it highlighted just how apprehensive lawmakers were to put what was clearly a criminal organization out of business. But that may be a solution. Officially, at least, the reason we send people to prison is to keep them away from society while they are being reformed. That doesn't always happen, clearly, but that's the theory anyway. We can't put corporations in prison. Fines don't work. And there isn't the political will to shut down employers, but we can give them parole officers. Forcing companies charged with illegal acts to accept a representative onto their board of directors to oversee decision-making could both help companies reform their governance and act as a real deterrent to decision-makers tossing up the cost-benefit trade-off of criminal activity. A man on the inside also makes it much harder to commit new crimes, and harder to cover up existing wrongdoings while the company reforms itself too. There isn't a right answer, but treating criminal penalties as just another expense line in the income statement is the wrong answer. Late last month, the paragon of wise economic decisions, Greece, introduced a 6-day, 48-hour work week. The country did this at the same time as its European neighbors have been successfully experimenting with shorter 4-day work weeks. But the Greek government has insisted that this new change is the key to turning its economy around by simply working harder than everybody else. It's a bold strategy, and for the sake of working conditions everywhere, we better hope it doesn't work. Unfortunately, it just might.
Greece has become the first country in the European Union to introduce a six-day working week for some businesses.
Now, the world's biggest trial of a four-day working week has ended in success, with the performance of companies largely unharmed and workers feeling healthier and happier.
The employer says, this is it. Take it or leave it. You can't do anything about it. This is Greece.
Greece has an aging and shrinking population. According to the country's statistics authority, over 500,000 young, educated citizens left the country to find work with better paying conditions elsewhere. It's very easy for Greek workers to find jobs that pay better in other countries, because as members of the European Union, they are free to reside and work across borders with very few restrictions. In order to correct for this loss of manpower, the government has decided to introduce a 6-day work week to make up for all the workers who have left the country and to support all the elderly people who can no longer support themselves. By raw arithmetic, their logic makes sense. Kind of. Output is the hourly productivity of a worker multiplied by how many hours they work. If Greece has fewer workers, it can increase its output by getting those who are left to work even longer and harder. What they have failed to account for, though, is that a lot of the productive workers still left in the country might decide that they would rather go and work 4 days per week in Belgium for double the average salary than stick it out grinding 6 days a week for half the pay in Greece. If your country has a problem with young people leaving to find better work elsewhere, the solution is probably not to make working conditions even worse. But their new plan argues that by getting on their hashtag grind, they can bring people back by just paying them more. There is also an argument that longer hours tend to be the hallmark of highly compensated professions. C-suite executives, medical practitioners, investment bankers, corporate lawyers, and senior tech workers all regularly put in long hours, and they are all generally well compensated for that time. These professionals are expected to be on call all the time and meet the demands of their clients and patients who simply can't wait. Hospitals have been routinely understaffed and have been relying on staff working longer overtime to keep operations running. These long hours have been linked to unnecessary patient deaths and worker burnout across the country. But doctors and nurses who are willing to stay on call for these odd hours can make an absolute f**k ton of money. Investment banking teams are doing much less important work than medical professionals, and they spread their teams even more thin so that fees on transactions only need to be spread between a few overworked team members. In my own personal investment banking experience, even on very large deals, we never had a team larger than 5 people because managing directors knew that the analysts and associates had to grind it out anyway. And why would they share their bonus with more headcount? If Greece can become the place where people work harder, they should attract these kinds of high-paying jobs, right? Well, not really. Greece already has high unemployment, and anybody who could work in these roles has likely already left to somewhere like London, Frankfurt, or come here to America. For most jobs, there is absolutely no need to be in the office 6 days a week. If you work in an office, you know that you have a set of tasks to do, and once they are done, your new task becomes looking busy for the rest of the week. But that's exactly the point. This law isn't really targeting office jobs. In fact, most of them are explicitly excluded from this law. Instead of magically creating high-paying jobs like promised, what this new law is really about is squeezing the most out of workers on the other end of the pay scale. Retail, transport, construction, and hospitality are jobs where companies just need someone behind a counter or on the tools for as many hours of operation as possible to serve customers periodically. A large share of what's left of the Greek workforce are in these types of roles, and businesses are already demanding a lot of extra hours from their employees. Greece may have a reputation for a laid-back lifestyle and 3 p.m. siestas, but according to data from the OECD, the average Greek actually works a full 80 hours per year more than the average American, and we are already way above average. The average German, on the other hand, works 500 fewer hours every year, and they are still more than twice as productive as workers in Greece. High unemployment has meant that employers can ask a lot from their employees because finding another job is extremely hard, and replacing a worker that isn't willing to work some unpaid overtime is extremely easy. This new 6-day work week is really being sold as a way to formalize what's been going on in workplaces across the country already. To make matters worse, the wording of the law makes it all sound very optional. DW reports that while the 40-hour workweek is still officially in place, employers are permitted to require staff to work up to 2 unpaid hours per day for a limited period in return for more free time. The problem is that if businesses have the option to ask their staff to work 2 hours of unpaid overtime every day, and those staff can't say no, then that's just going to be the new normal. In the same article, an emeritus professor of labor law is quoted as saying, "Law 5053-2023 will kill off the 5-day workweek for good, so it's probably not as optional as politicians would like workers to believe. Some people may leave, but most of those who can already have. Better opportunities exist in other EU countries, but a lot of Greeks don't have the resources to move their families across Europe to compete for a job against a local in a country like Germany. This is about squeezing what is left from who is left." Look, I normally try my absolute best to form a rounded argument that represents both sides when addressing stories like this, but this 6-day work week is just f***ing dumb. It won't make workers work harder. It won't create high-paying jobs. It won't improve productivity. It will drive away what few young workers the country has left. It will lower hourly wages and create terrible working conditions for the whole country. It's all around terrible policy. But unfortunately, it's not just Greece doing this. It's easy and sometimes even fun to laugh at dumb decisions made by out-of-touch politicians, but the Greek problem is not just a problem in Greece. Greece is a very expensive country to live in because it's so popular with wealthy tourists who make their money elsewhere. But the minimum wage is only 830 euros per month, according to wageindicator.org. That means the average Greek needs the extra work anyway, whether it's legally mandated or not. But let me make a big, bold claim here. Wages haven't kept up with living expenses anymore. Crazy, I know. But the way we are dealing with it is kind of strange. The good news is that the average employee almost everywhere is working fewer hours than we used to in previous generations. According to data from the OECD, annual hours worked per worker have declined significantly since the 1950s. But you would be forgiven for thinking that it doesn't really feel like that, and you would be kind of right. The amount of time workers are spending at work has gone down, but the total number of people has gone up a lot too. Put it simply, what this means is that even though the average individual worker is spending less time on the job, the average household is spending more time working, because it's now much less likely that a woman in the household is a stay-at-home parent. Now, women having the ability to enter the workforce in a meaningful way has been positive progress, but it's also now become a necessity. Having a stay-at-home partner, man or woman, is an unaffordable luxury for most households in America, especially younger workers. This means the average household is dedicating time to more work, and household chores are not taken care of by a single person while another person focuses on work. So while these numbers might look like we are moving in the right direction, the reality is a little bit more complicated. You might have also noticed that the number of people in the workforce is actually going down, but that's largely because as a larger share of our population gets older, some of them can retire while still of working age. This was accelerated by a huge drop at the start of the pandemic when a lot of people who were almost ready to retire were laid off and just never went back to work. This is also great. People should be able to retire and enjoy their twilight years. But with an aging population, this also put more pressure on younger people to pick up the slack. What this means is that there is a bit of a disconnect between what these charts show and what the average worker will experience. According to a study conducted by ADP Research, the average American worker is now doing 9.2 hours of unpaid and often unreported overtime. That is a number suspiciously close to the extra hours that are going to be demanded of Greek workers. The only difference is, they were dumb enough to say it out loud. That also doesn't account for the growing number of people working in a full-time role and then doing informal gig work or freelancing on the side. The number of new businesses created in America has exploded in recent years, and while this is normally a sign of a healthy, prospering economy, there might be a little bit more to this data. According to the US Chamber of Commerce, 5.5 million new business applications were filed with them in 2023, an all-time high. But suspiciously, these new business applications were coming from the states with the worst employment problems. People are not really starting businesses anymore because they have a great idea and want to capitalize on it. They are starting them to formalize income from informal work like Fiverr, Uber, and yes, even YouTube. According to a Bankrate survey, more than 1 in 3 Americans now have a side hustle on top of their full-time job. And more than 30% of respondents said they expected to need the extra income their side hustle brings in for the rest of their lives. The number of people doing a side hustle jumps to almost 50% amongst Gen Zers and is obviously significantly lower amongst baby boomers who either just have one job or are retired. Picking up a side hustle in addition to your full-time job can be an amazing way to start a business while maintaining the safety of a stable-ish income. I did it while starting this channel, and Richard from The Plain Bagel made an amazing video recently about why he still works his full-time job instead of just focusing on his almost 1 million subscriber YouTube channel. The key difference here is that it was a choice, rather than a necessity. Mr. Bagel is probably doing well for himself with his YouTube channel, but that's not your typical side hustle. Ted Rossman, the credit analyst that ran the survey, said that while it's admirable that so many Americans are putting in extra time and effort into their side hustles, it's unfortunate that most are doing so simply to fund their expenses. This is especially troubling since if side hustles are just a way to increase income as opposed to building up a business or monetizing a hobby, then they are mostly a pretty terrible waste of time. Most people with a side hustle who were surveyed were effectively just working another job that paid well below the minimum wage. So while it looks like the amount of time you spend working has gone down, and you might even be lucky enough to live in a place experimenting with a 4-day work week, we haven't filled that extra time with leisure or just getting a good night's sleep. We have split domestic work, taken on second jobs and side hustles, and just stuck around answering Slack messages off the clock. A lot of us are working 6 days a week. Greece was just the only one to admit it. Companies have been trying to cut down on workers for as long as those workers have demanded pay and benefits. Whether it's downsizing, outsourcing, streamlining, understaffing, or automating, if there is something a business can do to get rid of workers and their salaries, you better believe they are going to do it. But this time does feel a little bit different. Recent AI advances have been mocked for not quite living up to the bold claims of their tech bro founders. But even in their current imperfect form, LLMs, general use robots, and generative models are already replacing jobs, and they are getting better every day. So that's bad for workers. But if you're a senior corporate executive or company owner, maybe you should be asking yourself, if we automate everybody's job, who is going to buy all of your shit?
A new study out today predicting almost half of all global jobs could be affected by artificial intelligence.
That 40% of all jobs around the world will be impacted by AI.
And found AI could replace 300 million full-time jobs, including positions in the legal and engineering fields.
So far, there are 9 robots here doing the work of more than 250 humans.
I have some good news and some bad news for your theoretical company. The good news is that labor reduction systems of all varieties have already cut out millions of man hours in America alone and made the workers who are left more efficient at their jobs. Artificial intelligence is just another tool that your company can use to get more work out of fewer staff or replace teams entirely. Even here at Little Old Works Media Group, we used to have someone working part-time whose job it was to cut out images on Photoshop to use in our goofy little animations. Now, Adobe Suite has inbuilt AI features which can automatically remove backgrounds from any image with absolutely no human time or skill involved. Now, we love our editors, so we gave him more work editing our history videos. But there are a lot of companies that now don't need to or don't want to employ people for these simple jobs. According to a survey of 697 companies conducted by Metrigy, a research and strategic advisory firm, whatever that means, companies who did not use AI in calendar 2023 hired 89% more agents than those who did use AI in their contact centers. For existing employees, it was even worse. When AI was added to a contact center, 36.8% of companies laid off an average of 26.1% of their employees. These alarming numbers were within just 1 year. And just within call centers, which have already been hit by outsourcing, understaffing, and automation harder than most other professional services. For now. So, congratulations. Your business now has reduced headcount and significantly reduced expenses. But here comes the bad news. In 1914, Henry Ford doubled the salary of his factory workers to $5 per day. The story goes he did this because he wanted all of his employees to be able to afford a Ford Model T of their own, boosting company revenue. Now, this is basically complete nonsense. In reality, Ford just wanted to reduce staff turnover and deny talent to up-and-coming car companies like Dodge to maintain his monopoly over the growing automobile industry. But as with every good fairy tale, there is a nugget of truth in there. If the employment rate suddenly drops as hard as it did in the call centers from the study in every company around the world, then companies will undeniably struggle with reduced revenue as people without jobs don't have the buying power they once did, and even people with jobs will cut back out of fear that they might be next. But there is a business plan that you, as a hypothetical titan of industry, might want to consider so that this isn't a problem. And that's just making stuff exclusively for other wealthy business owners while diverting resources away from people who have nothing to offer you that can't be done more efficiently by a machine or a cheaper worker on the other side of the world. Now, if you think that sounds a bit crazy, you should know that it's already kind of happening. And the best place to see it is in video games. Yes, those occasionally fun distractions from real life are the perfect example of this shift happening in the real world right now. So let me cook. According to Grandview Research, the video game industry is now bigger than the movie, music, and television industries combined, and it has honed in its most profitable strategy. Free-to-play games are ironically some of the most profitable games on the market, because they have perfected a business strategy called freemium pricing. Most people will play their games for free, but a select few, affectionately known in the industry as whales, will spend thousands, sometimes even millions of dollars on a single game to unlock in-game perks that would be almost impossible to obtain as a free user. It's important that these games still have free users though, because without them, the whales would have nobody to show off to or pwn with their paid-for advantages. In a world where people are looking for budget-friendly forms of entertainment, the game industry has realized that the best way to turn a profit is to cater to those who have the financial means, or at the very least, the credit limit, to spend ridiculous amounts of money on a video game. The people who have the most financial means don't work for their money. They own income-producing assets. And if automation does replace jobs on an even more widespread scale, that will make your ability to work less valuable and simultaneously income-producing assets more valuable. The rate of change in AI and automation makes the future impossible to predict. But if the people investing in these technologies want to see a financial return on that investment, they are going to learn what the game industry already has. There is more money to be made by catering to other rich people, and everybody else can be kept around as entertainment. Now, if you think that sounds a bit depressing, well, welcome to this channel. But also, I should tell you that market trends already say this is happening. AI isn't going to change your world. It's just going to continue a trend that's already been happening for years now. In the 1992 movie Glengarry Glen Ross, the iconic Always Be Closing scene has Alec Baldwin's character bragging to another salesman about driving an $80,000 BMW. Adjusted for $1992 dollars, according to the Bureau of Labor Statistics, that would be the equivalent of just under $182,000 today. That is a very expensive automobile, to be sure. But these days, if you drive around a major city, you're likely to see dozens of cars that cost that much or more, and they probably wouldn't even stand out that much. According to company sales data and historic records, Lamborghini has sold more cars in the last 10 years alone than it did in all the rest of the company's history combined, because there is simply a bigger market for $300,000 cars than ever before. The same general trend is true for other extreme luxury brands like Bentley, Ferrari, Patek Philippe, luxury groceries at Erewhon, gym memberships that cost more than rent, hotels that make Hilton look like a Holiday Inn, and to top it off, private jets are all now way more popular than they ever have been. One thing that often gets lost in discussions of wealth inequality is that, yes, billionaires are getting richer. But there are also far more rich people around than ever before, and it's because the value of an hour of human labor has stayed more or less stagnant, while the value of an asset and the availability of credit has skyrocketed. People who held onto an even modest portfolio over the last 4 years now have enormous fortunes. Certain individuals got incredibly lucky with good investments, and other people accessed easy credit to get absolutely jacked to the tits on leverage and ride the longest asset bull run in history. Very few people have made modern fortunes through work alone. And you might have even noticed how investing went from something that you should do to secure your retirement to something you need to do to have any quality of life at all. If robots really do take over, then it will just continue to push the value of an hour of human work down, because it could be done by a machine instead. And it will rally the value of assets because business owners and investors will benefit from the free labor substitute. This is where people point to policy fixes like a universal basic income. If you haven't heard about this idea by now, that's impressive. but it's basically a government payment made to everybody, regardless of personal financial conditions, that should be enough to cover basic living expenses. It's been proposed as a solution to keep the whole system going if people can't earn an income for themselves because their labor has been outsourced or automated. But that is still not a desirable outcome for anybody. If comprehensive automation of human labor gets as far as needing this, then you will fall into one of two defined classes of people. You will either be getting by based on a government lifeline, or you will be in the class of people that own the businesses complaining about all the taxes they need to pay to fund that lifeline. I find it a little bit easier to sympathize with one of those groups. But there are still no winners. Just last week, the results of one of the most comprehensive universal basic income experiments was published. The research gave 1,000 people living in Texas and Illinois $1,000 a month with no conditions attached. To qualify for this study, their 2019 household income had to be less than 300% of the federal poverty line, or $37,470 for an individual. There was also an unlucky control group of 2,000 people who were only given $50 a month. This is because when your personal finances are being studied, you are more likely to be careful about your spending decisions, and the researchers wanted to control for these changes. The study itself was funded by an organization called Open Research, which is not technically affiliated with OpenAI, but they are both managed by Sam Altman, who has been very vocal about how this technology could displace billions of jobs. Now, if you ever find yourself running an AI startup that burns millions of dollars a day, then one of the best ways to ensure that you keep that investor money coming is to pretend to be really scared about how your technology is going to replace workers, because, well, replacing workers is really exciting to investors. So realistically, this study was probably little more than a marketing stunt conducted by one of the best-funded organizations in the space. But that doesn't mean that the results aren't still interesting. The key results related to employment was that the group that received the $1,000 payment ended up earning significantly less for themselves than the control group. After the payment was accounted for, they still earned more. But $12,000 alone is not enough to live anywhere in America without other forms of support. All households ended up earning more. But that was largely because this experiment started right at the beginning of COVID, when employment, particularly in low-wage professions, was hurt by lockdowns. The reason the researchers gave as to why households receiving the subsidy ended up earning less money for themselves was because many people took it as an opportunity to cut down on how much they were working and commit more time to leisure and looking after their family. This fits the optimistic idea of an AI future where we can have machines do everything for us while we just relax and collect universal basic income. But the findings still told a story of people who were financially struggling. Mental health improved because people were less stressed, but those improvements faded by the end of the first year. Food security also increased, but again only in the first year, as even people with additional income fell victim to rising living expenses, and that was when they could work to earn additional money. When compared to being plunged into poverty, it's an okay compromise. But this isn't going to happen overnight. Outsourcing turned entire cities in America into ghost towns. But it happened so slowly that big changes like this never got addressed. The endgame for people investing in automation is to build that automated utopian future. The endgame for everyone else is to make sure that they aren't excluded from it. Now, if you want to get these videos a day early and get articles that can never be made into YouTube videos, then be sure to subscribe to my email newsletter linked in the video description. Another big driver of people working all this extra overtime is to just scrape enough together for a down payment on a home. But to find out if real estate is inevitably always going to get more expensive, go and watch my video on how to make houses affordable without destroying the economy to keep on learning how money works.